MacCast, Monday, January 15th, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. I hope you are doing well. Hopefully you are having a great 2018 so far. I have to say, you know, it's always life that is seems to be crazy. And schedules and plans and all those things kind of get wild, and you never know what's going to be going on, but hopefully things are going well for you. Things are still going well for me, and we have certainly a lot of things to discuss now because it's been a little while. Looking over the show notes, we have a number of things to get into, including that whole Spectre meltdown thing. Yeah, you've probably heard about that, so you may know a lot about it, but we're going to try and dig into that. I'm still a little bit confused by it. But anyway, talking about Apple and parental controls, looking for more original TV show content coming from Apple. Yep, there's going to be some of that. Some stuff going on with Jimmy Iovine and Apple Music that we will discuss, and maybe some updates to iPhones and maybe not MacBooks. I'll fill you in on all that stuff. And of course, CES happened. Apple wasn't there, or were they? Yeah, we have that to do, and then I have some great follow-up from you, more stuff on Apple's battery program. I know some of you are getting those replacements, so we're going to talk about some of those experiences and things like that. We're going to talk about some cool ways to use the iPhone X, potentially, to do game development, something that I ran across, an article I want to talk to you about and get your opinions on. Also, we're going to try to help some people out in China with the whole changes that are going on over there. And actually, just a question about using multiple app stores. I know there's some of you out there that do that, and we have a question from a listener, and hopefully we can help them out. And then a little weird thing with Apple Pay and wallets and NFC to kind of round out the show. So it should be a good episode. Before we get into it, though, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Casper. Hey, look, you spend one third of your life sleeping. I know it's a lot of time. So shouldn't you be comfortable? The original Casper mattress combines multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep service with the right amounts of both sink and bounce. I have a Casper mattress, and I have been sleeping on it for years now, and one thing I can personally attest to is the comfort and support. We love our Casper mattress. For me, it really is the perfect mix because I like something that's a little firmer, but you still want it to be soft and comfortable. So it's not too squishy. It has the right amount of support for me, but you do sink in just the right amount, not too much, not too little. And the other thing I can attest to is the quality of the mattress. Ours has held up where in the past our old traditional mattresses have really failed. We used to joke with our old mattress about the divot that it had in it, and we've now had the Casper, like I said, for a number of years, and it is as supportive and comfortable today as it was when we unboxed it years ago. And don't even get me going on the whole delivery and unboxing experience. It's really a whole different experience when buying a mattress. I never thought I'd say buying a mattress was an enjoyable experience, but it really was with Casper. It came, the unboxing, just how it unfolds and unfurls. You can't believe they can cram that into the size box that they do, but it works, and it's really, really neat. And they have affordable prices because Casper cuts out the middlemen. They sell directly to you. They also offer two other mattresses now, the Wave and the Essential. The Wave features a patent-pending premium support system to mirror the natural shape of your body, and the Essential has a streamlined design and a price that won't keep you up at night. They're all designed and developed and assembled in the U.S., and you can get free shipping and returns in the U.S. and Canada. And you can be sure of your Casper purchase with their 100-night risk-free sleep-on-it trial. So you can try it out for 100 nights, make sure it's the right mattress for you. But it's going to be, they're amazing. And you get $50 toward select mattresses now by visiting casper.com/maccast and using the code MACCAST at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. That's casper.com/maccast and use the code MACCAST at checkout and you will get $50 towards select mattresses. And a huge thanks to Casper for their support of the show. Unfortunately, we've got to start the show by talking about a couple of flaws, like major flaws that impact just about everybody that uses a computer or a device, I think. There were a couple of design flaws they've been named Spectre and Meltdown. Like I said, you've probably heard about them at this point. And they were found in chips from Intel, AMD, ARM, and others. Now, I don't want to go into a lot of the nitty-gritty because, frankly, I don't really understand it, but I'm going to do my best to let you know what I understand, and hopefully between myself and you and the community, we can get this all sorted out. The thing up front that I want to say is this is a pretty serious design flaw and bug, but I don't think we need to panic, and that's kind of what I want to get into. So what are the flaws? I think that's where to start. And a couple of the design flaws are design flaws in the chips. Intel appears to be the most impacted. ARM has said that some of their processors are impacted, and AMD initially claimed near zero chance that they were impacted, but later they admitted that the Spectre bug is actually applicable to a number of the AMD processors. So, you know, everybody kind of got hit by this thing. It was a zero day. It was discovered by a team at Google and confirmed and discovered at the same time by a few other organizations. Like I said, there's two different hardware vulnerabilities here. Meltdown is supposedly a flaw that only affects Intel processors and basically melts down, where it gets its name from. I think Rene Ritchie wrote that in his article, and I thought that was a good description. The hardware security boundary that is in the chip's kernel memory. So the chip has the ability to kind of have this space that's supposed to be just for the kernel in memory, and this exploit appears to work by software being able to actually get in and get at that memory when it shouldn't be able to. It shouldn't be able to see that stuff. It shouldn't be able to bypass those keys. And it's possible that this exploit can be in CPUs going back all the way to 1995. Now, the Spectre flaw is in processors from Intel, AMD, and ARM, and it relies on something, or it takes advantage, the exploit takes advantage of something called speculative execution. And without getting too deep, the issue basically could allow an exploit or a rogue program to again access protected kernel memory. So both of these kind of focus around how the communication happens inside the chip between the kernel and the memory that's inside the processor. And a lot of this is typically hidden, or should typically be hidden, from user processes, things like your apps. So when things are running on your system, you have system processes and root processes that are running, and those should be protected and only available to the kernel. And then you have user processes for things like your apps or your browser. And because the kernel memory is meant for more secure system info stuff, things like passwords and login keys, cached files, can actually live in that memory space. And when it's my understanding, when it's being read back and forth by the processor, it's open and it's not protected. And what was supposed to happen is there was this hardware boundary, these boundaries that shouldn't let your third-party programs, user processes, and things like that access that. But because of the flaw in the actual chip design, those protected spaces have a way to become accessible by processes that shouldn't be able to access them. So this impacts Mac, Windows, Linux, iOS, Android, and even in some cases, especially with Spectre, could possibly be exploited via a browser attack using JavaScript. So that's the synopsis of kind of what the flaws are, without getting into too much technical detail. Now the question is, do you need to worry? As far as anybody knows at this point, it's not anything. There's nothing out in the wild that's exploiting it. They've kind of kept this flaw under wraps in terms of the nitty-gritty details. That doesn't mean that somebody hasn't secretively figured it out and is maybe doing something, but and a lot of the details at this point are kind of sparse because they're trying to keep it under wraps. I did read that for Spectre, there is a proof of concept JavaScript attack out there that was developed by the researchers who are looking into this stuff. Who knows if that's out in the wild, but you know, again, the presumption is if they can do it, somebody else could potentially do it. But companies are working together, Apple and Intel and everybody, Google, everybody involved is working very, very quickly to push out patches. And there's a lot of patches pushed out already. You've probably seen some of them, and more will be coming. So what is the fix for this thing? Well, the fix is there's something called kernel page table isolation patches that people are pushing out for specifically, I think, the Meltdown exploit. And what this does is this moves that kernel memory into a completely separate address space. Basically, they move the memory so that the running processes on the system can't see it, but it also means that it's moved for the system processes. And what does that mean to you and me? That means that processors have to kind of dump a lot of this cached data, the data that would have been accessible through this exploit, and now have to read that information back in when they need it from memory. Why do we care about that? Well, that's where you're hearing about the fact that this may possibly slow down CPUs, and some reports are claiming anywhere from between 5 to 30%, depending upon the specific situation. And the reason is because the patches remove some of the memory performance capabilities that were built into the chips. And a lot of people have cited the fact that the chip manufacturers were really concentrating on speed, and they may be screwed up in their designs because they weren't paying as close attention to the security. Again, those are allegations. I don't know enough about this stuff to say one way or the other, but a lot of people are saying they were optimizing performance over security, and that's maybe where they got bit by this. Now, as far as those percentages, it's looking like most of us are not on a daily basis, even with the patches applied, going to notice a 5 to 30% decrease in CPU performance. Now, there are some exceptions with things that really use virtualized memory or are really relying on that memory space, things like databases, virtualization software. So if you're using Parallels or VMware, any kind of VMs are going to be impacted potentially by the performance of this stuff. And also for developers and stuff like that, if you're compiling software. So a lot of things that are happening at a much lower processor level could be impacted by these performance hits. So it's going to be a pretty big deal for, say, cloud storage providers or people who are running servers and big server farms. And Amazon's having to deal with this. You know, Microsoft, Apple will have to deal with this with their iCloud. And it's probably going to mean they're going to have to bring either on more machines to kind of make up the slack or whatnot. But for you and I, it's probably not going to be that big a deal. And you're really going to want to apply your patches to protect yourself. So the final question would be, how do I protect myself, right? Well, Apple has released updates for the latest versions of iOS and macOS to address the Meltdown issue. And they've also issued Safari updates for macOS, going back to macOS El Capitan or OS X El Capitan. And that should deal with the Spectre exploits for now. Now, the one thing I've been reading is that Apple has only brought out macOS updates for Meltdown for macOS High Sierra. So if you're running Sierra and haven't upgraded yet, and I'm definitely in this group, you may want to consider upgrading if you want to protect yourself from this. But I'm really assuming and hoping that Apple is going to push the patch out for at least the last few versions of macOS. But at this point, from anything that I'm reading, it doesn't seem like they've done that. Now, it's different for Spectre. Like I said, they did release a Safari update and patch for Spectre, going back to El Capitan. And you're going to want to patch all of your browsers. So if you're not a Safari user, if you use Chrome, or if you use Firefox, or whatever browser you use, you're going to want to check into this and make sure that they've pushed out the patches specifically for the JavaScript stuff so that that exploit can't be taken advantage of on your machine. And, you know, the bottom line on this is it's the same as it always has been when we talk about security and exploits. You want to make sure that as much as possible, you're running the latest and greatest versions of your operating systems, that you're running all of your software updates, and you're careful about the websites that you visit and the software that you install on your Mac, because a lot of these exploits, again, rely on user processes, and the way user processes get run on your system is when you run your software and your apps and things like that. So if you've installed something that has an exploit to take advantage of the flaw in the chip, that's how you could potentially get compromised. And so by running your patches and making sure you're up to date with all your software and you're careful about what you're installing and you know what you're installing on your Macs and devices, you should remain relatively safe. And again, there's a lot of smart people that are, you know, making sure that these patches are coming out as quickly as possible. So that's everything with, you know, as far as that, I think we need to know when it comes to Meltdown Inspector. As more information becomes available, of course, I'm going to try and share it with you. And if you know more about this stuff, if you work in the security industry, if you work on processor designs and can maybe explain a lot of this technical stuff to us a little bit better, I welcome your comments and your emails. Send those to maccast@gmail.com. Now, one other small little security thing that came up this week that I want to point out to you, there was a small password bug, another small password bug found in macOS High Sierra. It was a flaw that could potentially allow anyone who is logged into your Mac with an admin account to access and change the App Store system preferences pane using any password. So normally you have to click that little lock and you have to enter your admin password. You could put anything in that box, apparently, in the latest version of macOS High Sierra, and it would let you right into the system preference panel. Now, I want to point out, in order to do this, you do need to be already logged into an admin account. So unless you have your auto login on and you're logging in automatically to that admin account, presumably the only other way to exploit this or take advantage of this exploit would be to know the admin account password. And if you already know the admin account password, then you could already click the lock and enter that in, so, and gain the same level of access. And it's also very important to note that that preference pane was the only one that seems to be exploitable this way. So the security preference pane, which also has the lock on it, that doesn't work there. It doesn't work, as far as anybody can tell, in any other system preference pane. So again, I don't think you need to worry about this one too much. Apple will have a patch for it, I'm sure, very quickly if it's not out already. I haven't checked things this morning. But it still is another area where Apple has a little bit more egg on its face when it comes to OS, macOS security. You know, it's just another example where they've kind of missed something that seems pretty obvious, and it just doesn't look good for Apple. And Apple's already come out and said they're going to be reevaluating these processes. They're going to put more focus into that team that QAs and checks this security stuff. So hopefully we won't have these in the future, but there's always little bugs and things that slip out. And the real, I think, thing to think about is how quickly are people responding? How quickly are patches getting put out? And as long as that's happening in a timely fashion and the companies are being transparent about what's going on, I think that's the best that they can do. And I think Apple's doing a pretty good job here. So Apple investors say they want more and better parental controls in iOS and on the Mac. Two major investors in Apple, New York-based JANA Partners LLC and the California State Teachers Retirement System, penned an open letter to Apple urging them to offer more controls to help manage kids' access specifically to their mobile devices. And together, these two investment groups control about $2 billion worth of Apple shares. So they have a little bit of pull. And in this open letter, they kind of cited a study that revealed the negative effects of smartphones and social media on children's mental and physical health. Apple, for their part, responded in a statement to the Wall Street Journal, basically saying that, yeah, we agree. We think there should be good parental controls and ways to monitor kids' access and usage on mobile devices. They pointed out the fact that their products already have many of those tools and technologies built into them, things that can help parents oversee the content and the apps that their children are using. I personally use Apple's parental controls both on the Mac and on iOS, and for the most part, they're really great. A lot of companies require you to get third-party software to do that, and Apple has a lot of the stuff built in that you want. Could they do a better job? I think so, and I think that was one of the points of this letter. Apple even said in their statement they are continuing to look at ways to improve things, and they alluded to the fact that there will be more quote-unquote robust parental controls to come in future versions of iOS. What kinds of more robust controls? They didn't go in to say what they were doing, but I know there are two big ones that I get emailed about from you a lot, which are timed controls for iOS, both for the device, so the ability to say, okay, your iPhone is going to work between the hours of 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. during the day for certain things, so you can get on, you know, and then at night we can open it up and you can have access to your Facebook or your games. But during the day, we're going to limit it to, you know, the phone and the email and maybe your web browser, whatever parents want to do. So a lot of parents want more fine-grained control over, you know, what times and what kinds of access and to what kinds of apps kids have access to based on time values. And I think those would be really nice additions to the system, both for internet and cellular data. Also, better and more controls over access to data online. So can, you know, at what times of day can you get online and access certain things? And also just better content filtering and more control over the kinds of content kids might have access to. And I think those are all ultimately good things. I think generally we can agree that having more controls, more parental controls, is good. The only thing with this story that I kind of was a little bit hesitant about is I also think there's a big problem in our society with relying too much on technology to build in those controls for us. None of them are perfect. And look, kids are super smart. Like, if you don't think they're going to figure out a way to get around the parental controls, even if it's something as simple as borrowing their friend's phone to check their Facebook or to go online or to do social media because their parent didn't set up parental controls, right? There's a lot of ways to get around the technology. So I don't think anybody probably listening to this show believes this, but I have conversations with a lot of people who are like, oh, I need you to help me, you know, lock down my kid's phone. And anytime I have that conversation with them, I also remind them that, you know, you also just need to be open and be talking to your kids about a lot of this stuff. And you need to have trust, right? A lot of this is just you need to kind of do the things that parents need to do. And technology can't be a substitute for active parenting or engaging with your children. And again, I know a lot of you know this, but, you know, I've personally been guilty of using devices and technology as, you know, babysitters and maybe not paying as much attention. And I have to remind myself, hey, we need to be having open conversations and we need to be talking about a lot of these things. And, you know, it's a good conversation to have. And certainly, again, having more access to better controls is a good thing and more controls, but you also can't just enable the controls and think the technology is going to take care of this for you. You also need to be doing those things to have those conversations with kids and, you know, keep an open dialogue. So I think all of it together is important, and all of that together is what represents, you know, parental controls and controlling access to kids and mobile devices and how they feel and stuff like that. So we need to do it all together. All right. I can't remember if I brought this up on a previous show or not, but you know that new Apple store in Chicago, the one that has the MacBook Air style, really cool roof, you know, from the, and it's right on the waterfront. Well, Apple took a little bit of flack back in December, and I think late December, early January, because they had to rope off the stairs next to the store and put up a bunch of big signs warning customers about the potential of snow and ice falling off that roof. And when that story broke, many alleged that this was a sign that Apple's architecture firm didn't do a good job, that they forgot which city this store was in, and the fact that Chicago gets snow, and there were allegations that they had put form over function when designing the store and had not thought about snow falling off the roof, and that's why Apple had to put up the signs and stuff like that. Now, I heard when the story broke from many of you who live in that region that these signs actually aren't uncommon for many buildings in the downtown area of Chicago, that they'll rope off areas under certain buildings, and it's just something that's part of winter in Chicago. So that was the first thing. And at the time the story broke, I also thought, wow, this is odd. You would think they would have accounted for that and thought about it. But also, why had they not just simply built like a warming system into that roof? That roof is really high tech. You know, put some heating pipes in there that would simply melt the snow and prevent it from even accumulating on top of the roof. And lo and behold, turns out they actually did exactly that. Apple came out with a statement and said that the problem wasn't the roof design itself. It was actually the software that controlled the roof. It had malfunctioned and wasn't doing the thing that it needed to do, and it needed to be tweaked a little bit. And this all came out from an Apple spokesperson. So it actually does have a heating system or some sort of system that manages the snow on the roof, melts it. And then a lot of people thought, well, if you do that, what about water pouring down on top of customers' heads? Because that roof doesn't have any visible roof gutters. What's going on there? Well, it actually has something built into the design that funnels and channels the water from the roof into the internal support columns in that hold up the store, basically, and funnel that down to, I would assume, you know, whatever waste system or water runoff system they need to have. So it all has been accounted for. It is a good design, and the architecture firm did do their job. They just had a little bit of a software issue. So they'll probably get that sorted out if they haven't already. If you happen to live in the area, I'd be curious if those signs have been taken down. I'm going to guess that they have been already. All right, as we discussed on many of our previous shows, Apple Entertainment, the guys in charge, the former execs from Sony who are in charge of pulling together Apple's new original content efforts, they seem to be signing up new shows left and right. Every week, it seems now, we've had a discussion about new shows, and this week is going to be no exception. We actually have three. First off, there is a drama TV series called Are You Sleeping? It's actually based on a novel by Kathleen Barber, and it will reportedly star Octavia Spencer, who you might know from movies like Hidden Figures and The Shape of Water. It sounds like this show is going to riff a little bit on the recent popularity of true crime podcasts. Yeah, a TV show that's actually inspired by real podcasts. The series is described as a psychological thriller, and in fact, it's about a podcast that reopens a murder case and deals with how that the production of the podcast actually starts to impact the life of the victim's daughter. So the stories about this murder case and the daughter's victim is impacted by the whole reopening of this thing. She tried to move on, but now it's sort of coming back out. And actually, Sarah Koenig of the Serial podcast is reportedly consulting for the series, and it's going to be produced by Reese Witherspoon's Hello Sunshine and also Charon Entertainment Endeavor Content. So two companies Apple's working with on some other projects that we've talked about. You may remember that they're reportedly Reese Witherspoon's company's reportedly working with Apple on another drama series that's going to be focused around a morning show, and it's actually going to star Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston. So that's the first one. There's also, according to Variety, a new series called Home, and this is actually a documentary series that's going to focus on extraordinary houses and their creators. So one of these shows that shows off really amazing houses, but then supposedly they're going to dive in and talk to the people who designed and built them about what they did. And I have to wonder if this isn't a little bit inspired by Apple building their new campus. But supposedly the series will include 10 one-hour-long episodes, and those are going to be produced by Mac Tynower and Corey Reese of Altimeter Films. And then finally, we have an epic world-building drama series set in the future called C. This one is reportedly being written by Peaky Blinders creator Stephen Knight and will be directed by Francis Lawrence, who has worked on The Hunger Games, Catching Fire, and Mockingjay. This one, they don't know for sure, but supposedly it's looking like it's an 8-episode deal. Not a lot of other details are available, but again, this is one that is being produced by Charon Entertainment and Endeavor Content. I don't know why I have trouble saying that, but this is the same company that's also producing the Are You Sleeping drama series that we mentioned earlier. So, you know, these three are now joining this massive growing list of Apple original content series that are in the works. At this point, we really have no idea when or how Apple is planning to release this content, but a lot of it sounds like some really cool shows. And it had been said that Apple was really looking for high-level stuff here. They're reportedly spending about $1 billion in 2018 on new original content. And I'm really looking forward to seeing some of it. Will we see it this year? I'm thinking it's starting to feel like we will see something this year, maybe an announcement in, you know, October, with new entertainment content somehow coming to iTunes. I'm really hoping it's going to be part of an expansion of the Apple Music subscription service, maybe into something bigger and not a whole separate service, but I could see Apple rolling it out as a separate thing as well. So lots of things going on around Apple and entertainment. And sort of keeping in the realm of Apple and entertainment, earlier last week, Billboard reported that Apple Music executive Jimmy Iovine was planning to leave Apple or is planning to leave Apple at the end of August or in August. Now, the rumor started on a music site called Hits Daily Double, but Billboard says its sources also confirmed the rumor. The report claimed that his exit was being timed with the vesting of Apple stock that Iovine had received when Apple acquired Beats back in 2014. And Jimmy Iovine right now doesn't even have an official title at Apple, but he has certainly been instrumental in the success of Apple Music. He's negotiated a lot of the content and streaming deals, so this would be a big deal. The report didn't have any details on where or what they thought Iovine was planning to do when he left Apple, and they didn't talk about who would replace him, if anyone. And so that was kind of a little bit of not great news, but the thing is, at least according to Jimmy Iovine himself, he's not done at Apple, not quite yet at least. In a QA session at the Grammy Museum to promote the documentary The Defiant Ones, which is about his career and friendship with Dr. Dre, it's on HBO, and if you haven't seen it, it is really great. I recommend it. He said, quote, "There's still a lot we'd like to do. I'm committed to doing whatever Eddie, Tim," referring to Eddie Q and Tim Cook, "and Apple need me to do." He also said, quote, "My contract is up in August," but then went on to say that he didn't have a contract with Apple. He actually had a deal, and he was basically planning to work out that deal. What that deal is and how those details work, who knows? But basically, he's saying, "I'm not leaving Apple. I'm sticking with them." He also pointed out that the bulk of his stock is actually already vested a long time ago, and what's happening in August is just sort of the final portion is vesting, and that actually really bothered him. He expressed annoyance at the fact that the rumors made it sound like this was all about money, that he was sticking with Apple until he got all his money and then was immediately going to leave. And I think if you've watched The Defiant Ones, or if you watch it, you really get a sense that his motivation has never been about money. Yes, he makes a lot of money from this. He's benefited from all the things he's done in the music industry and hugely benefited by the deal Beats made with Apple, but I get the sense, especially from that documentary, that he really does all this because he deeply cares about music, he cares about the artists, and he really wants to make an impact. He's kind of more interested in his legacy, and I think he really sees Apple as a place where he can fulfill and live out that
that legacy. As a matter of fact, he's mentioned in multiple interviews that he thinks it's important for him to help the music industry with streaming, and he thinks they still have a ways to go before they get it right, that things are improving, but he can do even more. And he also mentioned that he really wants to help streaming music, quote unquote, come to scale. And when he was making those comments, he pointed out that the catalogs and original content from places like Netflix, Amazon, and HBO, the fact that they're building those up, those are a big deal, and pointed out that streaming music services don't have any original content. Now, he didn't go into details about exactly what that means. I don't know what original content, I mean, music is to me all original content, but I think the point he's trying to make is, you know, Apple's not producing original music content. They're relying on the labels and others to kind of do that. Also exclusive deals, you know, doing more exclusives and that sort of thing. So I have a feeling that maybe he's trying to work on ways for Apple to have more direct involvement with artists and give them an outlet to bring their creative content to fruition. So it's an interesting thing to think about. You know, does Apple become a sort of record label for at least some kinds of content? It's something I've been a little leery about because I think Apple's getting spread a little bit too thin. But those comments make me think that Apple is looking at that as a potential future expansion of what they're doing in music. I don't think Iovine was referring just to the TV entertainment stuff that Apple is working on. This really sounded more music related. So I don't know. What do you think about that? Do you have some thoughts or ideas? Should Apple start actually producing albums and music for artists, or maybe concerts and things like that? Let me know what you think. Shoot me some comments or emails, maccast@gmail.com. Are you a fan of the iPhone SE? I actually am. I don't own one, but I think it's great that Apple has a smaller form factor phone, and there are a lot of fans of that form factor out there. Well, you might be happy to hear this next rumor. It's a little bit of a sketchy rumor, but it says that Apple will update the iPhone SE this year, possibly bringing a updated chip, an A10 Fusion. But it also says that they will move the design to a glass back and possibly bring in wireless charging support. Kind of makes sense. I believe they probably will update the iPhone SE this year, maybe with a processor bump, but I really wouldn't expect much more than that. One thing I talked about on the Mac show with Jeff Gamet and Michael Johnston this week was I do think it would be nice if maybe they upped the base storage amount to 64 gigabytes. I think it's currently at 32, and it may make sense to just go with a single model. I think they do 32 and 128 right now. 64, I think, really is a sweet spot, so I could see them just knocking down to one phone, updating the processor, setting it at 64 with a really great price, and selling a lot of those. As far as the glass back and the wireless charging support, I don't think they need to add that, and that's going to drive the costs up a little bit, so I'm not putting much stock in that rumor. But I don't think the iPhone SE is going away. I think they're selling a lot of those devices. There's a huge, I wouldn't say a huge, but there is a portion of the market that really likes that form factor and that price point. And I think Apple will keep it around, just doing, you know, small processor upgrades. Think of it like the Mac Mini of the iPhone lineup. Hopefully it'll get updated a little more frequently than the Mac Mini does, but you kind of get my point. And speaking of just how iPhone sales and things are going, I did want to point out that Kantar World Panel came out with some numbers for the three-month period ending in November of 2017, and Apple's iPhone had kind of some mixed results. It lost a little bit of market share in Europe, just about 0.6%, and about 3.8% in the U.S., according to the Kantar numbers. But they gained significantly in China, 4.6%. So, you know, lose a little, gain a little. Apple kind of doing all right. As far as how they did with the iPhone X, the iPhone X looks like it did really well in Great Britain in November with 14.4% of the sales. It was the top-selling smartphone in Great Britain. It also topped out in Japan, according to the report, grabbing 18.2% of the share, followed by the iPhone 8 at 17%. 16.2%. But here in the States, in the US, the iPhone X was actually beat out by, luckily, a couple of other of Apple's other phones, the iPhone 8 and the 8 Plus. But it still gives, it still means that Apple devices were the top three sellers for November in the States. And just for comparison, Samsung's Galaxy 8 landed at number 6, which was the highest position of any of the Samsung phones. So Apple's still doing very well with the iPhone, maybe not selling as many iPhone 10 units as they want, at least looking at those numbers. Apple will have their own numbers when they announce their quarterly results, and we'll maybe get a little more insight into this. But I think Apple's doing okay with iPhone sales. It's not really surprising to me that the iPhone 10 is competing for sales with the iPhone 8 and 8 Plus, and I think Apple has already been aware of that. They knew that was a possibility when they decided to release basically two models of a feature phone in the same year. And I don't think they're going to be caught off guard by this at all, although some of the reports, when you read them out there, make it look like it's doom and gloom for Apple. But I think the iPhone is selling very well, and I think Apple's ultimately going to be very happy with performance when we get those quarterly numbers. If you're in the market for a new MacBook Pro and you're worried that Apple may obsolete you this year, DigiTimes says you may not have to worry. They put out a report claiming that Apple is moving a large portion of their current MacBook Pro production from their current supplier, Quanta, over to Foxconn later this year. And they're saying Apple is doing that because they're not planning any major MacBook Pro hardware updates this year. So they can kind of move around manufacturing because they don't have any big design changes. Foxconn supposedly has about 20% of the current MacBook Pro production, and Quanta is doing the other majority, the 80%. They say if this change moves forward, there will be more of a 50-50 split, with Foxconn producing 50% of the MacBook Pros and Quanta producing the other 50%. This report, I think, is not earth-shattering. Apple likes to have multiple suppliers so they can avoid things like bottlenecks. They also like to play those suppliers off of each other so they can kind of get the best deals. So I'm sure Apple's getting a great deal out of Foxconn. And since Apple did a major design revision with the Touch Bar MacBook Pros just last year, I don't find it too surprising that they wouldn't be planning any major design changes or upgrades. Now, this report from DigiTimes says hardware upgrades, but I expect that we'll see the typical refinements to the MacBook Pro lineup in 2018. Things like updates to the GPU, maybe the memory, faster SSD storage, better graphics, all of those typical things that we see in these cycles. And hopefully they'll also address some of the keyboard design flaws, keyboard issues that many have experienced. If they haven't done that already, I have a feeling they've already addressed that, because I know they've been replacing a lot of keyboards. I've heard from a few of you who've had to have your keyboards replaced on those models. But yeah, I don't expect big changes. Apple typically comes out with a big design change every 3, maybe 4 years at this point. So it's going to be a while before we see any radical new updates to the MacBook Pro design. It's just going to be, from this point forward, your typical nice updates. And I expect that's what we'll see in 2018. And then finally, in the news for this week, Apple does not do trade shows anymore, at least not big shows like CES. I know they're around here and there, but you know, ever since they kind of pulled out of Macworld and other shows, you don't see them too much with big booths on trade floors at trade shows. Well, CES happened this week, but that doesn't mean that Apple wasn't still there. They do have people typically on the ground. A lot of their suppliers and people that they work with are at these shows. So this year was no exception, according to the rumors. Bloomberg says that Apple reps were in town in Vegas at CES, and they were talking with, surprise, surprise, suppliers of augmented reality parts. Speculation being that Apple is planning to produce some sort of augmented reality accessory sometime in the near future, possibly a headset, something that integrates with your iPhone and AR kit. Tim Cook, as you know, has said on many occasions that he believes AR has a big role in the future of technology, and I think specifically technology at Apple. They are big proponents of it. I think AR Kit is huge evidence of that, even though it hasn't, I don't think, taken off as quickly or as big as maybe Apple or even myself has hoped. It's still really cool technology, and it's great that we can do it. I haven't seen too many quote-unquote killer apps, but there are a few out there, and we've talked about some of them on the show. If you happen to know of a really cool AR app that maybe we haven't discussed, certainly send me a link. Let me know about it. But we've heard these headset rumors before. They've come up time and time again a lot over the past year. And the possible time frame we're hearing at this point isn't even until 2020. So this really sounds like currently at Apple, it's kind of a research and development project. They are several years off from releasing any kind of consumer product related to this. And I know a lot of people worry about that because you see Microsoft with their HoloLens technology, you see a lot of the VR technologies that are out there. But Apple is typically very tentative about this sort of stuff. You know, right now, if you look at the applications, yes, there's a lot of really cool applications, but a lot of it's still really gimmicky. A lot of it's very much game focused. And I think, especially with AR and an AR headset, Apple wants it to be much more consumer focused and a little bit broader ranging. So I think with ARKit and some of the experiments Apple's doing right now, either publicly or behind the scenes, that's where the majority of their work on this is. But yeah, it's not too surprising that they're at CES talking to companies, trying to line up part suppliers, see what technologies are available and what they might be able to integrate into future versions of Apple products. And we'll just have to wait and see what they come up with. And we may not see it this year. We may not see it next year. It may be 3 years out. I think that's a little too far out. I don't know why the 2020 time frame. I would think we'd start to see something towards end of 2019, maybe mid 2019. But we'll just keep an eye on it, keep reporting on it. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show's sponsors, and that is Small Dog Electronics. Small Dog, these guys are awesome. They have been around in the Apple and Mac community since 1995. You've probably heard of them. You probably know about them, but if you don't, you owe it to yourself right now to go check out smalldog.com to check out all of their great products. They started the company by shipping products to Apple customers literally out of their living room, and they've grown to become a great place where you can buy all kinds of Apple and Mac products and accessories. And they're not just, they haven't become a big conglomerate warehouse company. These are real people, real dogs. You can look them up right on their website. Their phone numbers are right there. What I love about going through a company like Small Dog is you're going to get great personal service. So you can make your web order and you can get that friendly Mac community service that you would expect. They even have physical locations. If you happen to be in Vermont or Florida, stop in, tell them hi, tell them you heard about them on the MacCast. But for the rest of us, it's the website that you want to check out. They offer an amazing selection of new and refurbished Mac and Apple products and accessories. You can get a really great deal. So make sure that you're checking out the refurbished and clearance section. There's a lot of great stuff in there. They also have a growing focus on home automation products and stuff that has HomeKit compatibility, so it's going to work great with your Mac and your iOS devices. Stuff from manufacturers like Philips, Elgato, and Honeywell, so all the big names that you would expect. And you want to make sure that you're checking the site frequently because they put new deals up almost daily at this point. And if you don't do that, you might want to at least connect with them on their Facebook page because they post new deals and stuff there. So you really want to follow them, keep on top of what's going on, check the website often. And a great deal, you get no sales tax on most orders and free shipping on orders over $75. And for many items, they can ship the same day on orders made before 3 p.m. Eastern time. And then finally, best of all, because Small Dog is cool and they're helping out the MacCast, they're also going to help out MacCast listeners. They have a coupon code MacCast. If you use that, you get $20 off an order of $100 or more. So check out their website, smalldog.com. Find something that you're interested in and save $20 on your order of $100 or more by using the coupon code MacCast. And a big thank you to Small Dog for their support of the show. A couple shows back, we had a listener who wanted some help with being able to sync his bookmarks locally across all the browsers in his Mac. So he had a need to use multiple browsers for a project that he was working on and wanted to sync the bookmarks across all of them. I only use Safari and I use iCloud syncing to sync my devices. And so I didn't really have a great recommendation, but the community came forth and wow, I didn't realize this was going to be such a big topic. We shared a couple of other apps that you can use on the last episode. So if you missed those and are interested, go back and listen to that. But this week, Douglas chimed in with yet another bookmark manager, one that he's been using for a while. And I noticed that Adam Angst over at Tidbits also had recommended this or had a testimonial for this on the website. So it's got to be a good one. It's an app called URL Manager Pro. I will have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. It is $22.99 US. It's available on the Mac App Store if you want to get it that way. But what it looks like this one is it's actually a menu bar item. So it's kind of, it looks like it's in that genre of it's a separate app to manage your bookmarks, but then it integrates with the system and also with your browser, so it works across everything. So it's a bookmark or a menu bar item. You can just click up in the menu bar anywhere in the system and access all of your bookmarks and manage them from there. They also have access from your browser menu and also from the dock as well, and it can automatically back up your bookmarks to a file if you want, and you can even export it to services like Dropbox, which I think would help with migrating your bookmarks across multiple Macs. So Douglas said it's a great app, he's been using it and really recommends it, so I wanted to share one more bookmark manager with you, and there may be more to come. If you have one that we haven't talked about that you particularly like, excuse me, then go ahead and email us, maccast@gmail.com. Another thing we were talking about last week was Apple's iPhone battery program. We had the whole battery gate thing and we went through all that again. If you don't know what that is, go back and listen to the last episode of the MacCast. But it's pretty clear Apple has put out a new battery replacement program. So if you have an iPhone 6 or later with a failing battery or a battery that needs replacement, you can now get it replaced by Apple for $29. That's $50 less than the previous cost of $79. And they're going to be doing that offer through the end of December. But when the story broke, we didn't have a lot of details about how that worked. There was a lot of confusion up front that if you went into the Genius Bar or you made an appointment, that your iPhone 6 or later battery would actually have to fail Apple's diagnostic test. There has been several reports that came out that said, no, that's not the case. You can actually just ask for a new battery with any one of those phone models, iPhone 6 or later, and get the replacement for $29. I do want to point out that I have had a couple reports from listeners who have gone through the process at the Apple Store, and your mileage may vary. A couple of them said, yeah, they put it on the battery tester, and in one case, one listener even said they tested his battery twice before they would issue a replacement for him. It had to actually fail. So that contradicts some of the reports. I haven't had my personal experience yet, so I don't know. I am going to be replacing a battery. When I do that, I'll let you know how that went. But I guess I'd love to hear from more of you. Is Apple giving you hassle about getting your battery replaced, or is it a pretty easy process? I've heard reports both ways. The other thing that we've been hearing is that they are only allowing one battery per device to be replaced if it does not fail the diagnostic test. So once you've had it replaced under the program for $29, you cannot get a second $29 battery replacement this year unless that battery also fails the battery diagnostic test or fails the battery diagnostic test. So this isn't kind of a free forever $29 batteries. It's really meant to replace older iPhones out there that haven't gone through a battery replacement yet and really need it. And how do you know if your battery needs replacing? Well, the threshold is that, at least according to Apple, that through 500 complete charge cycles, the battery should be maintaining at least 80% of its original capacity. And we talked about some tools like iMazing that you can use to look at the number of charge cycles that your battery has gone through on your iOS device, or Coconut Battery is another one. And you can also look at how much of a percentage of the original capacity the battery is still holding when you put it through a full charge. So basically, if you're fully charging it and you've not reached 500 complete charge cycles yet, your battery should be filling up to at least 80% of its original capacity. If it's not, then you want to get it into Apple and you want to go in for one of those replacements. Now, how long does it take to get the replacement and how quickly are the replacements done? I've been getting reports from some listeners that replacements are going very well and pretty quickly, at least once the battery comes in. As you might imagine, Apple stores and Apple has been, they've been swamped with people wanting to get new batteries because this is such a great deal. So at the moment, what I'm hearing the process is like is once they've identified you need a new battery, they're probably going to have to order it. It's going to take 1 to 2 weeks for the battery to actually be able to come in. And then what will happen is they contact you to come in and actually have it replaced. Once you have your appointment and you go in for the replacement, I've heard it happens relatively quickly, somewhere between 1 to 2 hours for the replacement. I had one listener who said it took only about 45 minutes once he came in. And I am hearing reports that the lead times, how long it takes to get a battery, really vary by region. So you need to kind of plan ahead. Don't expect that you're going to be able to walk into an Apple store today and walk out with a battery replacement. It's going to take a little bit longer than that. And depending upon your model, you may be waiting even longer. There are reports out there of shortages of iPhone 6 Plus batteries. They are being scheduled out as far as March or early April at this point. So I expected things, I think I mentioned this on the last episode, I expected things to be pretty congested, especially right now since the program just launched, and I also expect it to be congested at the end of the year. There's a lot of people I've talked to and a lot of people who seem to be waiting, thinking, all right, well, I have an iPhone 7, my battery's totally fine right now, but why not jump in at the end of the year and get a replacement battery? That way I have a good battery moving forward. And I would say that's a great strategy. That's a great idea. But keep in mind, you're not the only one who's thinking that. There are a lot of people thinking that. So I bet November, December, it's going to be really bad and we're going to hear about battery shortages once again. So maybe you want to plan a little bit earlier than that. Think about doing your battery replacement maybe August or October and not waiting totally until the end of the year. And if you don't absolutely need a new battery right now, you may want to hold off a couple months, maybe wait till the spring, early summer to do your replacement, and maybe even schedule your appointment now. I don't know how far out Apple will let you schedule those appointments. But another thing to remember is Apple authorized service providers. I believe Smalldog is actually one of those. So if you need a battery right now and Apple has you scheduled further out than you want, you might check with your local Apple authorized repair center and see if they can do it a little more quickly. Now, chances are, because a lot of this is dependent on the supply of batteries, they might not be able to, but it's at least worth a call, especially if you're lucky enough to have that option in your area, because a lot of people don't have that option. And just remember, the program ends December 31st, 2018, and you want to make sure you get it done before the end of this year. And then one other thing related to something that I mentioned on a previous episode about batteries, I talked about the battery widget. I think this came up with the fact that on the iPhone X, you don't have battery percentage displayed up in the main menu bar anymore because of the notch and the whole split screen thing. And so you actually have to pull down into the control center before you can see battery percentage on an iPhone X. And the other way to check battery percentage that I had mentioned was just going into your control center, or your notification center rather, and then moving over to the today view by swiping to the left and then accessing the battery widget. And I believe I had mentioned, if you don't see the battery widget, you can scroll down to the bottom, you can tap edit, and you can add the battery widget to your list of widgets and put it in whatever order you want on that screen. Well, I received emails from a few of you that mentioned, hey, I don't see the battery widget either in the edit screen or in the widget view. And I thought that was a bit odd because it's there on all of my devices. Well, I did a little more research and many of you emailed me about this. It looks like maybe starting with iOS 10 or iOS 11 that In order to see the battery widget, for whatever reason, you need to have paired some sort of Bluetooth accessory with your phone. So in the case of my iPad, it's my Apple Pencil. With my iPhone, it's my AirPods. So I just assumed that battery widget was always there because it does show you the battery just for the phone yourself. So I'm not sure why Apple would make the requirement of that widget being available having a Bluetooth accessory connected, but I just wanted to point out, if you heard me say that and for whatever reason you're not seeing the battery widget, try just pairing your device just with any Bluetooth. And I don't think it has to stay actively paired. I think once it's been paired once, then that widget is available and you can continue to use it. But I don't know why you seemingly have to activate it that way. So sorry for any confusion that might have caused any of you. All right, this next story is just something I wanted to talk to you about because I think it's so cool. It actually was an article over at iMore.com, and I will link to that in the show notes if you want to read the full article. It's definitely worth a read. But they found and pointed out an indie development game studio called KNL Studios. They're developing this game called Babylon Battle Royale. It looks like it's going to be this game. I don't have a lot of details on it, but it looks like it's a bunch of baby characters that are going to do some sort of battling or fighting. There's actually a full video of the demo that I'm going to talk to you about on YouTube. I'll link to that in the show notes at mattcast.com. But as you might imagine, when you're developing a fully animated, a 3D game with fully animated 3D characters, a big part of your development process is doing the actual animations for the characters. So be it just their general movement, their facial expressions, also things like taunts, which are a big part of these kinds of games and stuff like that. All of that stuff has to be animated, and that's a pretty intensive process. Of course, there's a lot of tools that can make that process go more quickly or more smoothly, and one of those big processes is motion capture and facial capture, right? Being able to have actors and people just move either in a bodysuit or in front of a camera, capturing those into 3D coordinates and stuff like that, and feeding that into your 3D system so you can get a lot of the gross larger movements out of the way really quickly and then just have to go in and kind of fine-tune things. The thing is that traditionally large studios are able to use actors and go into big expensive 3D motion capture environments and use rigs and set up big sessions, but that stuff costs a lot of money. It's very hard to do. And so for an indie studio, you end up doing stuff a lot more by hand, and that can take a lot of time. Well, KNL Studios is actually working on and developing a custom system that's a little bit more affordable. They're using a motion capture suit that they were able to purchase online. I didn't see the price on that, but what I really wanted to talk to you about was this custom built DIY helmet rig that they built using a couple of iPhone 10s to actually in real time capture the facial expressions of their characters as they're doing the motion capture stuff for the body movements. And the rig has these iPhones attached to it, iPhone 10s, and because of the processing power of the iPhone 10, they're able to grab, they built a little custom app, and they're able to grab facial data, including things like eye movements and all the facial expressions and stuff, in real time, and then capture that to a data file that they can then bring into a 3D animation tool like Maya and have the characters already, again, animated, at least from a first pass in terms of their facial expressions and stuff like that. And the cool thing is that this helmet rig that they built, not including the iPhone 10s, of course, cost about $200. But you add in, a couple of iPhone 10s at $1,000, $1,100 a piece, and you're maybe looking at $2,500 for a full rig where you can capture facial data in a way that you can feed it right into your game. And the full setup is still thousands less than it would cost to do a fully professional motion capture session and setup. And it's just kind of amazing to see that this is where technology has brought us. This kind of power just a few years ago would have taken at least desktop class machines, like big workstations with tons of RAM and all this stuff. And now we're able to do this sort of thing on an iPhone. And I just thought it was a really cool example of really how far we've come. And I mean, even if you look at technologies like ARKit and the augmented reality stuff that's happening with the iPhone, it's pretty incredible to think about all this stuff. And, you know, sometimes when you're just using it day in and day out to check your Twitter stream, that slips by you a little bit. And this was kind of a good reminder for me that, you know, these things are super powerful computers that can really do a lot. And it's always neat to see somebody taking that and pushing the limits on that stuff. So if you want to check out the video or the article over at iMore, again, I'll have links in the show notes at maccast.com. And if you happen to run across cool stories like this, because I know this is only one example of some really creative and innovative ways that people are using Apple's technologies, always feel free to shoot me, you know, links and stuff like that. Let me know about cool stuff that you see, because I can't see everything and I really rely on you and the community for that sort of stuff. So shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Some of you may or may not have heard recently that Apple is making some big changes to its iCloud operations in mainland China. The government actually has a policy that is requiring data on Chinese citizens to be stored within the country. And because iCloud gathers that stuff, Apple needs to change some things to be in compliance. Now, this is a little bit controversial, and I don't want to get into the political aspects of it, because that's really not what we do here on the MacCast. But the point is that Apple has decided that it is going to hand over its iCloud operations, or work with a local partner on its iCloud operations in China, GBDC. So they're going to be taking over iCloud data in February. And so as part of the planning for that, Apple has sent out emails to a number of their mainland Chinese customers saying, hey, this change is coming. If you don't want to be part of it, you know, the data is moving from Apple corporate over to this third-party company that we've partnered with. The privacy policies and stuff change a little bit. So if you're not happy with that, you can opt out at this point, which unfortunately basically means you'd have to cancel your account in China completely, your iCloud account, and couldn't use it. But more importantly, for people who have another country of origin, those people who are not Chinese citizens but are maybe living in China, they have the option to actually just move their data and their services back over to their country of origin. And now at this point is the time to do that. So if you're doing that, you know, if you're in that situation, that's what you want to do. And you've probably already been notified by Apple about the change. And the reason I'm talking about all this and giving you the background on all of this is that there's a broader thing going on here. And that is, there are a number of people all over the world, and a number of you are in this group, who you live in a different country than maybe you are from, and depending upon your banking situation and your credit cards and stuff like that, which Apple store you use internationally may be different, you know, from the country that you're from or the country that you're living in. And that means that you might have stuff that you've purchased in one country and you have stuff that you've purchased in another country. And that whole process is all a little bit complicated, right? If you've bought apps in one store and now you're trying to deal with another store, that can be problematic. And listener Gavin emailed me because he's one of these people. He's an Australian. He's lived in China for the last 6 years. And so now he's facing this dilemma because he got this email, and he's not really sure what to do, because for convenience, he's made most of his recent, you know, over the last few years, App Store purchases and subscribed to Apple Music, and he's using iCloud all under a Chinese account using Chinese bank cards. But he doesn't want to have his data moved over to the new Chinese data company. He would prefer to stick with Apple for, I think, a lot of obvious reasons. The trouble for him, though, is that all those app purchases are made in the one store. And yes, you can, when you switch from, say, the Chinese app store over to the Australian app store, you can re-download and install anything you purchased from the Chinese store. But the dilemma is, for some reason, in Apple's you know, setup of iTunes, and we know iTunes is kind of a mess, the purchased section only shows purchases from that you made in the store that you're currently logged into. So if you're logged into the Australian store, it's only going to show your Australian iTunes purchases, even though it's the same account on, say, the Chinese store, right? So if you use the same account, you logged into, you know, multiple stores, then the purchases are still separated, which is confusing. And it really means that if you want to re-download an app, you don't really know if you, unless you specifically remember, you don't know if you've already purchased it. So the way it works is you can still re-download. So, for example, Gavin can re-download his Chinese purchases on the Australian store and it won't recharge him. But because they're not in the purchased section, the only thing you can do is go to the actual app page and there it shows a buy button because, again, the store doesn't know that it's already in your purchases. It's not until you click the buy button that it'll pop up and say, oh, we see that you've already purchased this. You can download it for free. But as Gavin points out, it's a little bit like credit card Russian roulette. Like, am I going to get charged for this? I think I bought it over on the Chinese store, but I don't really remember. So it can be a little bit scary. And so he's curious what people do, you know, other than just going from memory. How do you manage this stuff? How do you deal with having multiple international iTunes store accounts? And I'm not in that position, so I don't really know, Gavin, and that's why I'm going to throw it out to you in the community. Can you guys help Gavin out? How do you manage this? I know one trick that sometimes people use, at least for purchases, is to use gift cards, but you still have to have gift cards from the store you're in, and that really doesn't solve this, you know, I already purchased something problem that Gavin is having. The only thing that I could think of, and again, we're going back to iMazing, but it is a really cool tool. It added a new feature recently, and this was more to deal with the fact that Apple took out of iTunes the ability to manage your App Store purchases, right? You can't go into the App Store on the iTunes app on your Mac anymore and see your purchases and download and manage your purchases. So iMazing actually built a feature into their latest version where you can download your previously purchased apps and IPA files directly to your Mac through iMazing, and then you can manage and install those onto your devices through iMazing. So for you, Gavin, I thought maybe one thing you could do is download all of your purchased apps from the Chinese App Store, so you at least have local copies of the IPA files, then switch over your accounts, and then you would at least, at the very least, have a list of all the apps that you've already purchased, right? You can go in to whatever folder you save those IPA files in, and you can see, okay, I bought this, I bought that, I bought that. So you have at least a little more insight. And you could even use iMazing to install and manage those IPA files directly. The only disadvantage is that if there were updates that came out, I think you'd have to log back into the Chinese App Store and download those updates through the iMazing app. I don't think they're going to show up. Maybe they will. I mean, maybe they will show up when you log into your iTunes account. Because again, I think it's more working on the back end of going in and directly looking at the store. And I know, I don't know if it sounds like it ties into your purchase list. So I really don't know. I'd test it out. I didn't have a couple of international accounts to test it out with, so I don't know how it's going to work. But again, maybe some of you in the community have more ideas for Gavin and how he can kind of solve this dilemma. So if you do, if you have some insight, if you have some thoughts, shoot us an email, maccast@gmail.com. And then the last thing that I have for you today is a little bit of a dilemma with Apple Pay and NFC. And this came from listener William. He had something happen to him recently when he purchased an airport bus shuttle ticket, and it gave him the option to get a QR code sent to his email to use as his ticket. So more and more we have these systems and apps and stuff like that that give us digital tickets, and they use a barcode or a QR code or something like that. And this would be outside of Apple's wallet. I think a lot of us also know about Apple wallet passes, but in this particular case, you have an app or something that just sends you, you know, a PDF or an image that basically has this barcode QR code on it. So he purchased this, he got the email, he got the QR code, and the issue came about when he went to use it on the QR code scanner on the bus, because when he went to hold his phone up to have the QR code scanned in, it activated Apple Pay. And why did it do that? Because a lot of these scanners are now getting NFC readers built into them, and apparently your iPhone, the minute it sees an NFC reader, it assumes that you're trying to do Apple Pay, and it activates the credit card interface and says, hey, you want to pay with Apple Pay? But that also meant that there was no way to bring the QR code up. Every time you would get it close to the scanner to get scanned, the screen would go away and Apple Pay would come up. So luckily, the driver of the bus took pity on him and let him on, and it wasn't that big a deal. But in doing research and looking into this, this is becoming a more common occurrence for a lot of people. It's not an isolated incident. Maybe it's happened to you. Now, luckily, if your ticket is able to go into Apple's wallet app, so if you have the ability to get it as a pass or get it into wallet, I recommend that you take that option, because I did a little bit of testing, and this is not a problem for tickets or things that are in your wallet. Once you're in the wallet interface, it seems to lock out or block out NFC for Apple Pay. But the problem is that other apps, including Apple's own apps like Photos, because one thing I thought for you, William, is, well, what if you just take a screenshot and then you put that into Photos? If you're in the Photos app, will that prevent Apple Pay from activating? And no, I found out that's not the case, at least not in my testing. And there have been reported issues with other apps like Dropbox. So trying to save the PDF into the Dropbox app, that doesn't seem to work either. So really, I think other than can I get it into the Apple wallet, I'm not sure that I really have a good fix for you on this, other than maybe printing it out, I guess, and just having a hard copy. But it seems like Apple may need to get a little bit smarter in the future about detecting when an NFC reader has become active and is available for a payment versus something else. I read reports when I was looking into this that some of those little restaurant pagers that you get, you know, when you're waiting for your table, some of those apparently are starting to have NFC chips in them, and even getting your phone near that will suddenly activate the Apple Pay. And I may have experienced this a few times with my Apple Watch getting too close to some NFC reader, because there have been a few times when I go to check the time and I notice, oh, the Apple Pay interface is up. What's going on with that? And I hadn't put two and two together until I got your email, William. So, you know, the ultimate question that William was asking was, is there a known way to temporarily disable NFC for Apple Pay so that you can use, you know, use these tickets without NFC activating Apple Pay? And I don't know of any, actually, William. The only thing I could think of is you could turn off Apple Pay, but you don't want to do that because you'll lose all of your credit card data and you'd have to re-enter all that stuff, re-verify all that stuff. And that is a giant pain in the butt. As anybody has ever been through that process knows, it's not ideal. So I'm opening it up again to the community. If you have any ideas that I'm not aware of, I haven't thought of, let us know. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But I think ultimately Apple is going to have to figure this out from a technical perspective. And I'm sure they're aware of it. I would certainly go to apple.com/feedback, William, and let them know you've had this experience and that it's a problem and it's something that they need to address. And anybody who has had this problem should do that. And the more Apple hears about it, the more likely they are to actually issue a fix in a future software update. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Just real quick before we get to thanking some of our sponsors, I also want to thank you, the community, those of you who have signed up for the MacCast Patreon and pledged your direct support to help me out. It really means a lot to me. If you can spare a dollar or a couple bucks a month, that goes a long way to help supporting the show, helping me pay my bills and support my family and keep food on the table. Lets me produce more podcasts. So it does. It means a great deal to me. We have the Patreon campaign. We're trying to set up some rewards. I'm working on the membership cards for those of you who are Patreon supporters. I've got a couple suppliers that I'm looking into, and hopefully we'll be posting some designs up there pretty soon so you can kind of see and maybe vote on some of the designs for your card. And then hopefully in the next month or two, we'll be starting to get those out to those supporters who are pledging at the $5 or more level. But if you want to check out the Patreon campaign, see the rewards, everybody gets access to the Slack channel who's a Patreon supporter. So at any level, you're going to get that. So check it out, patreon.com/MacCast. And again, big thank you to those of you who have supported already. I also want to give a big thanks to my sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS. You can check out all of their great software. Get more information and details by going to smilesoftware.com/podcasts. And that's actually another great way to support the MacCast. If you don't do the Patreon, support those companies who support us. All of our sponsors are really great, and they help make the shows possible as well. So big thank you to them. And then we have our other supporters, Cashfly, who supplies our bandwidth. You can find them at cachefly.com, and Backbeat Media, who does our advertising. You can check them out at backbeatmedia.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline, that phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave voicemail there. And as I mentioned, if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or the MacCast Google Plus community at google.com/plusMacCast. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.